May it please the court. In this case, the district court committed the very same legal error that it committed in LPSC. It entered summary judgment against Union Pacific because it failed to appreciate that compelling a railroad to allow physical occupation of its property constitutes a taking under Article 1, Section 4 of the Louisiana Constitution. All we're asking this court to do is to correct that error.
This is where I'm a little concerned about the procedural posture we're in on this case, where you requested from the district court and it granted and we granted this interlocutory appeal. So we're here on an interlocutory appeal from the denial of summary judgment on this as-applied challenge for a case that was removed to district court. Assuming we said, well, the district court was wrong, we're going to remand, then what? Do we go back to summary judgment again? Are we going to go to trial? What's going to happen here?
All right, Your Honor, thanks for the question, because it is a bit confusing, and it would be nice to clarify it. The court not only denied our motion for summary judgment, but entered summary judgment on its own, sua sponte, for the other side. If this court sends it back, it could be sent back for either further summary judgment or for trial, I mean, depending on how the case proceeds, like any other case.
Now, the second thing I had a question about is where is our call from the district court's opinion. It said that UP, and I found this, I just couldn't understand why this would have happened, and I want you to clarify this for me. It said UP never proved any possessory interest in whatever the easement was involved in Falk or something, as if UP hadn't presented documentation or anything. And I know that probably isn't the case, so clarify that for us.
It's absolutely not the case, Your Honor. First of all, there were two different statements by the court, one in its first opinion, where granted it denied our summary judgment motion and announced that it was inclined to rule sua sponte against us, and then there was a second opinion where the court actually did rule against us. In that second opinion, the court clarifies that it's not deciding the issue of ownership. It thinks that that has to go to trial. And the court rightly made that decision. We tendered a lot of documents in between those two rulings. If this court,
what's left in this case? I think I'm missing something. What's left in this case if we say that the state is entitled to sovereignty? Wouldn't we vacate the? In other words, there's no jurisdiction in the federal courts. The district court's opinion would be vacated.
All right. Your Honor, I think this is very different from the other case. Let me try to explain why. I think in the first case, if you think sovereign immunity exists, you'll simply vacate the decision below and get rid of all of it. In this case, it's kind of odd. I mean, you had a suit between two private parties, two sets of private parties, where the state comes into it voluntarily and now wants to say, that sovereign immunity will bar the entire action. My answer to that is, if the state doesn't want to be in the case anymore, the state can, it's fine with us. Exactly. They can ask the district court for permission to withdraw. Nobody's forcing them to be there. We didn't sue them. They can leave the case. The notion that leads to a vacator of the entire action, I think, is truly bizarre.
It intervened. It's not a party until it intervened. I mean, that would be affirmative litigation strategy under Lapidus.
That's right, Your Honor. So one way or the other, it either is going to say that 204.03 is a true intervention, in which case it intervened and it's waived, or 204.03 is not a true intervention, it's some sort of a hybrid, in which case it has no business telling anybody what to do with the case in terms of vacator.
And expressly reserve their sovereign. You run into a problem as, how is that an unequivocal waiver?
Well,
they expressly don't waive it.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court actually dealt with that issue in Lapidus. In Lapidus, the state said, but we're in this case and we've removed it for benevolent purposes. The reason we've done it is we want the other defendants to be able to take advantage of the interlocutory review that's available in federal courts. So we've removed for their convenience, and then we're going to ask it to go back to state court. And the Supreme Court said, whoa there. We don't really care what your internal reasoning was and whether it was a nice reason or a bad reason. We're going to take you by your action as to what you've done here. And In this case, the state intervened under 2403, and that would be a waiver. Either that.
They became a party. They weren't.
Sorry.
They came in voluntarily as a party, not as a, not in their role of advisor on the law of Louisiana.
That's right. It's not an amicus brief, Your Honor. And the Clark case from over a century ago says that intervention will waive sovereign immunity. So I don't think that point is well taken. Their argument that somehow this is a facial challenge, I also find a bit puzzling. If you look how the constitutional question came up in this case, this again was just a dispute under Louisiana law over who has what property rights. The plaintiffs raised the statute against Union Pacific and said, well, this statute says that you can't close the crossings anyways, even if you do own the properties, and even if you have the right to exclude, you can't close them. And we said, that statute can't apply against us. It's unconstitutional. Well, obviously, we're just talking about these 9 crossings that remain in this case. That's all it's about. We haven't asked for a declaration. We haven't asked for an injunction against the state. All we're saying is let us litigate as to the 9 remaining crossings what our property rights are.
Is this case ripe?
I don't know how it could be more ripe.
Are your challenges ripe? In other words, this is all, there's no proceeding under the statute.
Okay, I think I get where your Honor's going. We're in a circumstance where we're saying that we ought to be able to prove, because Louisiana property right law gives us this right, we ought to be able to just unilaterally act to close these crossings if we want. We own them, or we have them in servitude such that they're our property. To make us go through that proceeding is already a taking. It's already a temporary taking of our right to exclude, and it's already...
The process itself is a taking.
That's right, Your Honor. The LPSC has no ability to adjudge our property rights. They're not going to look at that issue, and they have no ability to look at the constitutional law question as to whether it's a taking. You can look at the ALBE-LB case,
well,
97,
that
on that.
Why shouldn't that be decided in the course... Why couldn't that be decided in the course of an actual action by the state of Louisiana, where at that time you make these defenses and you make these claims against the process and the taking in that case?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we could go to the LPSC, lose, because we're not going to be able to demonstrate that all of these crossings each constitutes a substantial interference, certainly under the Franks-type test, and then try to, make an appeal or something to the Louisiana courts. But the state has already conceded that, unlike a case where your claim is that you're not getting just compensation, when your claim is one that the statute, the act itself that's been taken against you is unconstitutional because the taking is predominantly for the use of a private party, you don't have to go through the proceedings like that. They've said that in the brief, and they're correct. You don't have to do that. The other thing is, when you talk about rightness, we're in the middle of a real case here. This is a true case between landowners as to who owns what property.
When Falk filed this action, was Franks pending? I know the Falk action was, I understand the Falk action was stayed pending Franks, but was Franks pending when Falk filed this action? Because several were filed, because Union Pacific announced we're going to start closing these crossings.
No, it did, Your Honor. Union Pacific announced closing its crossings in connection, as you know, with the federal program of reducing the total number of crossings. This case was filed in 2007. It was certainly before the Franks decision came out. And then, as you know, it was stayed in connection with Franks. And, of course, what Louisiana has done here is really very different than what was at issue in Franks. It's the opposite, in fact, mere opposite. Franks, you had a case where the railroad was taking the position that regardless of who has what ownership rights, even if the railroad has no right to close the crossings, it can do so as a matter of preemption. And this court said, no, you can't, not unless there's substantial interference that would lead to preemption.
Well, we first said it was okay.
You first said it was okay, Your Honor. And then Louisiana took a huge step past that and said, even where the railroad has the historic property rights that have existed for 200 years to exclude others from the property, you still can't close your crossing unless you wait 180 days and prove that it's a substantial interference. Under Loretto and under all of the state cases that are similar, that's undoubtedly a per se taking. And, Your Honor, we can't wait to say that the statute can't be used against us in Falk to prevent us from putting forward our state law defenses and our state law claims. There's no waiting about it. Either we're going to lose because the statute says we lose in state court, or we're going to win that argument and be able to assert our property rights. But we had no ability to say, let's hold up and wait on this. We're in the middle of actual litigation about our property interests.
So you would want, assuming we agreed with you, the most narrow ruling we could give would be that for, as you say, where you have the right to exclude whatever the district court might decide on remand, that cannot be trumped by the Louisiana statute.
Not even that, Your Honor. I won't even go that far, although I'd be pleased to get it. I think all we're really saying is that given the district court's assumption at this stage, on the summary judgment stage, that we do have the right to exclude with respect to these properties, Louisiana law would adjudge the statute to be a taking of those properties. Now, whether that taking is unconstitutional depends on whether we're right that the taking is predominantly for the use of the adjoining landowners. That would be enough to make us win, or alternatively, we could win by showing that there isn't a public purpose that the legislature itself had for that. Two ways for us to win. But we're not asking the court to rule on those. Those would be for the district court on remand.
Then you would want us to say, on the most narrow basis, that the Louisiana statute is a taking if you have the right to exclude.
That's right, Your Honor. And that's all we're asking for in this case. If there are no further questions, I'll wait for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bress. Yes, you've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Verlander. All right, okay, Mr. Bergethon, you're going to go first. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Verlander is going to take the second 10 minutes of the argument. I think it's important that we clear up a fundamental misconception about the nature of this case first, because Union Pacific is conflating two different types of claims here. This lawsuit began as a dispute over private landowners and the nature of their ownership interest in the land. No one disputes that. The takings claim, which came much later, was framed in exactly the same terms as its LPSC takings argument, and that was directed at the act in itself. In other words, they were claiming that the act was invalid because the process itself affected a taking. And Mr. Bress inadvertently reiterated that when he admitted that what they're saying is that the operation of the administrative process itself is what affects a taking. And the Supreme Court has said that's when the implementation of the law itself is what affects a taking, that's a facial challenge. Union Pacific never asserted a single factual argument about the particular crossings at issue in this case. They simply said the statute is invalid. It was virtually a word-for-word rehash of the LPSC argument. So what they're asking the court to assume here is that they're asking the court to overlook the fact that they've not proven any facts as to any particular crossing. That's what an as-applied challenge is all about. It's by its very nature, an ad hoc determination into the characteristics of the particular crossings. That's never occurred here. So a statement from this court that the statute was somehow unconstitutional as to those 10 crossings would be no different from a statement that the statute was unconstitutional as to all crossings, because Union Pacific has never attempted to differentiate those crossings. Another point.
Well, are these the private suit? If we try to interlace this idea of sovereign immunity, let's say for argument purposes you would have sovereign immunity. You get down to the lawsuit against the private parties. Is a statute going to make the private party? What is the claim against the private parties? The trespass? I mean, there's no claim that the private parties are taking property. That's a claim against the state or the sovereign.
Right.
What's the claim against the private parties?
They're essentially opposing declaratory judgment actions, asking for a declaration that the respective property holder has a right to either close or keep open the statute under purely property law grounds. And that can come down to an issue of the wording of a particular deed whether the conveyance.
Well, they're all individual cases.
That's absolutely.
That's my point. And that some of them may be constitutional once you put the interlacing of this law in, and some may not. But really, constitutionality doesn't have anything to do with that, does it?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the issues would come up as to each specific claim. And I think that the state, I can't say that absolutely if for instance, Union Pacific showed that it had a fee simple interest, there may very well be a taking, but there may not be a taking, because it's also important that the court recognize that the whole landlocked versus non-landlocked issue is not the only public interest at stake here. We've gone into a great deal in our briefs about the fact that the LPSC was very concerned that the closure of these crossings forced the farmers to operate their machinery on public roads. Cities themselves have written to the commission to complain about this. And then there's also the issue of emergency access. If we close these crossings, in some cases, it's going to mean that emergency responders have to go miles out of the way to reach the property. That may not always be the case, but that certainly may be the case, and we've never discussed those facts here. So to characterize this case as an as-applied challenge is really meaningless, because those facts have never been in play here. So that's a very important foundation from which that the court needs to start with to start its analysis.
No, it would seem that once this statute was amended post-Franks, perhaps Mr. Falk should have dismissed his action and let UP have to contend with the Public Service Commission under the statute.
Right. I mean, it would be just another type of...
that was not a friendly question. It would seem that Mr. Falk wants his cake and eat it, too.
Well,
and he's the one that left this action pending.
It would probably be more appropriate for me to let Mr. Verlander address that, but I would say, though, as to your question, though, that the question would be determined. It's just a question of the forum deciding the questions. But if the LPSC determined that adversely to one party or the other, there's a right to appeal that decision in the state courts. So there's no deprivation of access to the courts here.
Well, but Mr. Falk is the one that's kept this in federal court.
That's correct, and I can't speak to that because...
Right. I'm just observing. Mr. Falk is the one that's kept this in federal court, post-Franks.
Accepted. I would like to comment on the sovereign immunity issue because it does arise in sort of a strange posture here, because obviously this was private litigation. I would not concede at all, and I would say that it's wrong to assert that the state has, by definition, waived its sovereign immunity by intervening, because the state's actions here were still taken in a defensive posture. Accepting UP's argument here would essentially force the state into a Hobson's choice. If they've got a federal lawsuit with private parties challenging its statutes, it has a choice between intervening to defend it, which means it waives its sovereign immunity, or leaving the defense of its own statute to private parties who may or may not be motivated to defend that statute and may not be equipped to do so. So I don't think it's right to say at all that a state intervening to defend its statute is a waiver of its sovereign immunity, because that's why Union Pacific was required to serve a summons on the state of Louisiana and to give it notice that it was challenging constitutionality to facilitate this very action.
What about the Clark case that Mr. Bress referred to?
The Clark case, if I remember correctly, is a case from the 1890s that was superseded by the Supreme Court's later line of case law, starting with Ford, which was partially overruled, but with Edelman and subsequent cases. Now, Lapides did refer back to the Clark case, but in referring back to earlier cases, the Lapides court was very careful to distinguish between actions in which the state affirmatively invokes the court's jurisdiction and actions in which the state's in a defensive posture. And I would submit to Your Honors that even though the state technically intervened in this matter, it was still in a defensive posture because it was essentially forced to defend its own statute. So this isn't the case of a state intervening to assert some claim, affirmatively invoking the jurisdiction of the federal court. The state essentially faced no choice here from a sovereign immunity standpoint.
So what is the correct result in this case from the state's point of view?
Well, from the state's point of view, sovereign immunity is equally impactful because I'm not sure If the state, I'm not sure how.
Sovereign immunity answers the question, if it does in this case, then you're out. But we don't have an appeal of the rest of the case, right?
There might be an appeal as to the actual.
Okay, so that other stuff is still before the court.
Right. Essentially, if the court upholds the constitutionality of the statute, then the case just returns to the status quo where it was before before the challenge.
So what do you do down there? Do you come in as an amicus?
Well,
I mean, you're saying we've got this conflict between the suit between private people, and they're wanting to get a determination of a statute before it's ever put into force. And the state coming in and defending it, and you're saying, we're out. But if you're out, you don't really want to be out, do you?
Well, Your Honor.
What do you want? Or what are you going to do if you win? And you go and we say, well, you're entitled to sovereign immunity, and that's what's that gets you out of this case, right?
It would, but it.
But you don't want out of this case. What are you going to do in the district court if we say you have sovereign immunity?
Well, then the case just becomes a property dispute between two parties.
Okay, and the parties are still arguing about the constitutionality of the statute. Are you going to walk away from it again?
Well,
are you
I'm not.
Come back in? Are you going to say you're. What do you do?
I'm not sure if a court says the statute is unconstitutional, how that ruling would be enforced.
Okay. How can we say it's unconstitutional if we give you sovereign immunity?
The court would never reach that issue.
Exactly. Which is why I'm saying maybe Mr. Falk should have just dismissed this action.
Well, that goes to the heart of the problem here is that even if we set waiver aside, this is still a federal court opining on a purely state law issue, and that essentially amounts to an advisory opinion. It doesn't bind the Louisiana state courts. So whether it's really framed as a
federal court opines on state law issues all the time in diversity, that's what this action is, right? A diversity action.
It does, but
is this a diversity action?
It is, but
yes. Mr. Falk against Union Pacific.
The Supreme Court has said in Pennhurst, though, that a federal court cannot order a state to comply with its own laws when it's a purely state law issue. There are no federal laws at stake here. So besides just sovereign immunity alone, this goes to just the court's general jurisdiction under Article 3.
Well, let me get back to the question I asked a minute ago, and I understand we haven't heard from Mr. Verlander yet, but he'll have his full time. But in your brief, your concluding line is the court should dismiss this appeal because the state has sovereign immunity against Union Pacific state takings claim. I don't think you really mean dismiss the appeal, do you? You're not questioning the jurisdiction of this court to entertain an appeal from the action of the district court.
The court, technically speaking, has jurisdiction to entertain an appeal, but not to opine on the constitutionality, to enjoin the state from enforcing its own laws.
Well, aren't we sitting, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we're sitting in review of what the district court did.
That's correct.
And we have jurisdiction to do that.
That's arguable under a sovereign immunity, from a sovereign immunity perspective. Cut sovereign immunity out of the picture, and then I think, yes, there's no question that the court has jurisdiction. This goes to this odd nature of sovereign immunity itself. I mean, courts have analogized it to a jurisdictional, that's really the closest analogy, is that it's a jurisdictional problem. But it's a sticky issue, especially in cases like this one that also involve private parties.
I guess where I'm going, I mean, it seemed like a simpler issue. I didn't realize it would get this complicated. Aren't you really saying that it's the district court that has limited or no jurisdiction if there's sovereign immunity?
That's correct. Federal courts in general. Right. And I'm sorry if I misunderstood the question.
I'm just going by the statement in your brief, and I'm not trying to nitpick what you put here, but I'm trying to understand. There's no limit on this court's jurisdiction to review what the district court did. But you would have us, if I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, I want to be sure here, you would have us reverse the judgment of the district court and order a judgment of dismissal because of sovereign immunity?
That's correct, Your Honor, and I apologize if I misunderstood your question. We're speaking about sovereign immunity in the entire context of federal review here, not in terms of cutting off this court's review of the lower court, and I understand that that's what you were asking.
And if that were the correct ruling, that would allow the state to come in and intervene in any proceeding between private parties having to do with a state statute and direct to some kind of dismissal because of sovereign immunity, right?
Well, sovereign immunity isn't always going to be a clear-cut issue because oftentimes federal constitutional interests are at play, too. It's the rarer occurrence that the parties are invoking the federal court's jurisdiction purely to rule on state statutes as a state constitutional matter. So I'm not sure that the sweep of any ruling in this case would be as broad as Your Honor.
What does that do to the private party's action? What does this do to the action of Union Pacific and the private parties here?
I think under the terms
the private parties don't have sovereign immunity. If you prevail on sovereign immunity, is the case gone?
I think it goes to the impact of the court's judgment. If the federal court declared the Louisiana statute unconstitutional under Louisiana law, what would be the reach of that judgment? Is that binding on the state courts? And that's the tricky issue here with the sovereign immunity in this case.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Bergethon.
Bergethon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Verlander.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'm here primarily to address, I came here primarily to make sure that the court had some appreciation of the perspective that the landowners hold for this case. The railroad started digging up these crossings without any hearings about whether or not what its property right was in any particular crossing, without any determination of what was going to be affected by that. It just started digging them up. And it takes the position here that it has the absolute right to do whatever it wants to within that right-of-way. The history here is that in the 1880s, there were a group of farmers who owned land that ran east from the Washita River that was divided by absolutely nothing. And they granted a right-of-way to the railroad to run a train through there, to build a track. Different landowners granted different rights-of-way through different pieces of land using different language in the documents. They're not all exactly the same.
Is this all in the record?
Yes, sir. The copies of these documents are in the record, and there are depositions of the parties as to the history. So the railroad got built through there, but it went right through the middle of these gentlemen's fields in the 1880s. My immediate client, Mr. Falk's family, has farmed the same land since 1816. They've been going back and forth between those fields since 1816. And after the train was built, they went back and forth over crossings over the track. It was the only way to get into their fields. Those crossings have been there ever since the railroad was built. Then the state came in and built U.S. Highway 165 and in recent years made that a four-lane divided highway. So to get from the western part of his field to the eastern part of his field, Mr. Falk has to cross U.S. 165 and the railroad track. That's how he has to get there. There are only two east-west public roads. One of them is at the very northern end of the property of any of these landowners, and the other one is a short little dead-end road that abuts a field of Mr. Falk's and a field of River Valley properties. Otherwise, no public road touches any of these lands except U.S. 165, and you can't get across without crossing over the railroad track. That's what these crossings have been there for. That's what they've been used for. To have a global view that the railroad can just go dig them all up without going before anybody, and we'll determine later, after they're dug up, whether now is this field a landlocked track, which the railroad admits in its brief would create a right to have a crossing reestablished. Is this a tract that has some peculiar language in its deeds that gives it a right to a crossing? Or as a matter of state law, if you have only a servitude, just exactly what do you have? Does a servitude of passage give you the right to exclude the owner who granted it to you access to the other side of the your track? What if it's not a railroad track? What if it's just a road? A servitude of passage for someone to get to their hunting lease. The landowner, the farmer, can still go across that as long as he doesn't obstruct it. That's what our underlying claim was. Before I forget, you've been asking why didn't Mr. Falk just dismiss the case after Franks? Well, first of all, he couldn't have because the railroad had filed a counterclaim. So it wasn't entirely up to Mr. Falk whether this case would continue.
There was a takings claim pending.
And second, there was, the railroad had filed a declaratory judgment counterclaim saying that they had the right to, they essentially had the right of ownership where its track passes and had the right to dig these up. And we needed determination of that. As a matter of state law, we filed this suit in state court for determination of state law, state property law. The railroad removed it to federal court. I don't have a problem with that. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's how we wound up in federal court. And with a counterclaim pending, we couldn't simply dismiss. And if we had, we would have been back where we were before any suit was filed, with the railroad going out with equipment and digging up the crossings. The only thing that has we've raised.
Do you
that
really
issue
think the railroad would dig up the crossings in the light of this post-Franks amended statute?
I don't know, but they dug up one. After the statute, but they would certainly have, I suppose, challenged the statute first, one would think. All that the state has really done is said that you have to look at each one of these crossings case by case. Is it going to be a landlocked estate if you dig the crossing up? We have
Were there any negotiations with UP about both sides dismissing their claims in this action? I know there was a counterclaim pending, but that doesn't mean both sides couldn't have dismissed them.
There have been negotiations with UP about various things that did not result in a resolution. We're happy to go sit down around a conference table anytime they are willing to do
so. No, sir. I said about you would dismiss your claims, they would dismiss their counterclaim, then y'all would fight it out before the LPSC or something.
I don't believe we had a discussion about that. I think that we wound up with rulings before we got to that point, frankly. We have, just as a factual matter, and this is in the record, there is a man who lives in a house that can be accessed only by one of these crossings. He lives on the east side of the railroad track. There's no road to his house if there's the crossing is dug up. There is a landowner, Mrs. Hodges, who I represent, whose land does not touch any public road. And the only way she can get to a public road is that she has an easement across a field that Mr. Falk owns that gets her to one of these private crossings. If that crossing is dug up, she's a landlocked estate. The railroad admits she has a right to a crossing because she's a landlocked estate. All that the state has done with this statute is say that this case-by-case review of whether it is proper and prudent to take up the crossing should be done in an administrative context being litigated.
So are you seeking the same relief the state is seeking to have it dismissed based on sovereign immunity?
No. with great appreciation for Mr. Bergethon defending the statute, and I think the Attorney General has an obligation to defend its statute, I think that sovereign immunity would still leave the private parties litigating, and the issue of the constitutionality of the statute would remain. What we would like the court to do, of course, is simply affirm, which would not mean that the railroad ultimately loses or that anybody ultimately wins. It would mean simply that the Public Service Commission would be the first place that would review.
And then this would play out in the state regulatory system and in the state courts.
State courts. Or even, it's conceivable to me that if the Public Service Commission ruled that the crossings, one way or the other on the crossings, that it would play out in federal district court because of diversity. In this particular case.
But if we dismissed this action based on sovereign immunity, then you, Mr. Falk, would proceed into the Louisiana Public Service Commission, wouldn't you?
Well, I don't think you would dismiss the entire case.
It would be handled there. It wouldn't be handled by a district court or this court.
Only after the Public Service Commission had ruled and that decision is reviewable. In that context, it could wind up back in a court.
and nothing is going to be done to the crossing if we dismiss under this statute.
One would hope. I assume that that's true, yes. There's no reason for me to think otherwise. The railroad's entire case is premised upon the fact that it has fee ownership. It says that it has an absolute right of control of this property. We've disputed that. That's the premise of the underlying lawsuit. Then the district judge said, although Union Pacific alleges a taking of the rights conferred by property ownership, it has not demonstrated that it owns the property in question. It then went on to say, even assuming that it did own it, the statute's not unconstitutional. But the factual finding of the district court was that the railroad had not demonstrated the rights of fee title. And I think that stands unless this court finds that it is clearly erroneous. If there are other questions, I'm here to address them. But,
all right. Thank you, Mr. Verlander.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Bress, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Got a number of things. I'll try to be brief on each. Number one, if we look at page 21 of the court's opinion below, it was the final opinion of the court below.
The court, March 2011 opinion.
That's right, Your Honor. The court does say that we haven't demonstrated we own the property in question, but all that they're saying is we haven't demonstrated it at a level where we could actually win on summary judgment yet. It's not saying that we haven't put forward enough evidence that we own or have a servitude that would give us the right to exclude that we should lose on summary judgment. In fact, the contrary, it said those issues were left for trial. If the court is interested in where we've addressed these issues in the record, 1358 to 403, you'll find the deeds. You'll see a map at 248, 249. But the fact is that there's a live dispute about whether we've got the right to exclude through either fee or servitude in the case. Couple of other issues that I think are important here. Number one is that it's not so simple to say we just go back and deal with the LPSC. I know that's been suggested a couple of times, but if you relegate us to the LPSC, it means we've already lost. And the district court below enjoined us and said you can't close any crossings until or unless you go.
It means that you may have lost if you're wrong on your as-applied, I mean, your facial challenge, doesn't it?
We don't have a facial challenge in this case, Your Honor. It is an as-applied challenge. And when the state says that somehow we haven't put facts forward that would make it as-applied, I've just given you, for example, the record sites that show, in our view, that we own these properties. And our argument is that the statute can't be applied as to these properties without committing a taking. And when I say the statute can't be applied, I'm just saying the statute inherently is a taking of our right to exclude as to properties that we own. Because if we have to go before the LPSC and we have to give the 180 days and we have to, in addition to proving that we own the properties, prove that it's a substantial interference, we don't have that underlying right to exclude anymore. That's the problem. The right to exclude someone from your home means the right to exclude them, not the right to prove to some state commission that it would interfere with your life to have them in your house.
Is maybe the narrow middle ground in this action to just limit it to the specific crossings at issue in Falk and your property interest without getting into whether the process itself is a taking and just narrowly deal with the property at issue?
That's exactly what I would do here, Your Honor, is I would say that we should be able, our only argument is we should be able to litigate our property rights as to these properties vis-a-vis the plaintiff's property rights. Who really has the right to this? Can we really close the crossings under state property law without being prevented from doing that by the state statute? That's really all we're asking for, is to be able to vindicate those rights. You know, there has been an injunction against us, just so the court is aware. It's not as though the court below didn't use the statute against us in a way that is very concrete. The idea that the state could claim sovereign immunity, I'm sorry, but it is, in my view, laughable that in a case where we have made no claims for any relief against the state, we didn't sue the state, we didn't bring the state into this lawsuit, the idea that they could come into a suit in which the constitutionality of a state statute has arisen.
Well, even if they get immunity, it's hollow. I mean,
they're claiming that it means you vacate the entire case, not that just they get out of it. Their view is you vacate the entire case.
But part of your case is not against the state. It's against the landowner.
In fact, none of our case is really against the state, Your Honor. We're not asking for an injunction against the law or a declaration about the law. In terms of the facial as applied, the Supreme Court in Citizens United made clear that it's not how you frame the claim in your complaint that matters. It's the type of relief that you seek that determines whether it's really a facial or as-applied challenge. Here, the only relief we're seeking is to these 9 or 10 crossings. We're not seeking a declaration about the law at all or an injunction about the law at all. That's not a claim in this case. It's an argument we're making in defense, essentially.
But then why is it even an as-applied if what you're doing is seeking to prove that you have some fee or some other basis for excluding?
Your Honor, that's all we're trying to do. What happened is we counterclaimed and said, no, we've got the right to these crossings, and we have the right to exclude you, after the state sued us and said they've got the right, and we can't dig up the crossings. So it was just a state property dispute. But after the statute was passed, the plaintiffs said to the court, well, Union Pacific no longer can litigate its property interests in these crossings and get injunctive relief from this court or get a declaration from this court or indeed defend against our suit, which claims that we've got the rights, because this statute prevents Union Pacific either from proceeding with its state claims or defending against ours. And the district court agreed with the plaintiffs on that. All we're seeking is to be able to go back down to district court, prove that the statute in that context can't be applied against us to take away our property rights. We just want the right to prove that to the district court. That's all we're asking.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bress. Both of your cases are under submission. This panel is in